Good evening to Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. I've hoped you've battened down the hatches if you're in the Pacific. And to the hostile alien armies hovering silently behind their cloaking devices just outside of Earth's atmosphere, remember, eat the Canadians first. Happy birthday to the real Captain Mohawk, as he calls himself on Twitter. And even to the fake one. I wonder, does the fake Captain Mohawk also celebrate this day? At any event. Not a lot of celebrating going on in some respects here in Arizona. Sad night in the state with the death watch underway for Senator John McCain. As announced earlier today, he is foregoing any other treatment for his aggressive brain cancer. I was sitting 8 feet from him just a couple of years ago. He came to speak at a small group at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, from which I graduated with that degree when I came down here to Arizona. And I watched him more than anything else. I wanted to ask him a question, but there were so many youngins that wanted to get in with their question, and I thought, oh, I'll let them have their moment. But I did just watch him interact with people, and I found him to be very gracious. I know he had a hellacious temper, and it's somehow not politically correct to say nice things about him, but I will. And I like what he said once when he was asked, how did he want to be remembered? And it was just that he served his country. That is a harder thing, I think, for most people to ever say. And I think he deserves that. I hope that will be the message when he dies and not a bunch of, you know, vitriol that's unleashed upon him or his family. Wild night of weather, both in the desert southwest. I'm under a flood warning for the next 24 hours here. The monsoons appear to be breaking early. This is a season in the desert where you get a lot of these dust storms, these haboobs, and then they tend to be followed by massive thunderstorms or just, you know, deluges. And we've had one almost every other day for the last couple of weeks. It's now almost cool at night. And it seems like fall will come about a month than it sometimes does, which isn't until mid-September or something like that. But you got to be careful, though, with all this rain, because coming up next weekend, it's sort of an annual story. I hope it doesn't happen, but people that go camping for Labor Day make the mistake of parking in the dark and waking up to find themselves in a wash when the rains come down from the mountains. So be careful. Those washes, those are essentially dry rivers, except for about maybe half dozen times a year. And then they're, you know, they're these raging sluices of mud and rock that just come, you know, barreling down and taking everything with it. So be careful with that. Of course, nothing that we're going through here in this country on the mainland is anything like what they're facing right now in Hawaii. Worst of all, the most devastating phase of the storm is happening as we speak. We will not know how bad it will be until morning, but I'll give you details on what they're worried about the most, along with a little crypto news next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. A special shout out to the Smith family in Seattle. Heard from Richard tonight. Twitter, at Deacon Punnett, by the way, P-U-N-N-E-T-T, if you want to follow me on Twitter, said this is the first time that his dad is visiting from the ATL, from Atlanta. And he said this is the first time that he and his dad have listened to Coast together since he was a teenager and living at home. Love that. This show's going to be here forever, too. I'm in for George Norrie tonight, getting a jump on the big Sunday night performance coming up. But before we get to that, I want to tell you, coming up later on this hour, the author of a book called Strange Stars, about the confluence of the explosion of science fiction, of like really legit, great, world-changing science fiction that went completely mainstream, had this big impact on popular music. And then I would argue also in turn ended up having both of those things kind of come back recursively and have this big impact on science. We'll talk about that coming up with our author friend Jason Heller. You're going to really like the show. We're going to play some cuts here from things which are essentially science fiction in song. you will reconsider some of the songs that you thought you knew from a completely different perspective coming up. Then we'll do open lines for the rest of the night on Coast to Coast AM. So let me just get to a couple of crypto news items as promised. Bizarre condition allows man to turn his legs 180 degrees and walk backward. It's from an oddity website we linked up to at coasttocoastam.com. The guy's name is Moses Lanham. He's 57 years old. He lives in Michigan. He's become known as Mr. Plastic, although I don't know why. He has the unusual ability to turn his legs around with his knees 180 degrees and walk backward. So why not call him Mr. Backward or Mr. Elastic? But why call him Mr. Plastic, which usually implies rigidity? I don't know. Not a great nickname. I don't think they thought that one through. But you can see the video. If you go to coasttocoastam.com and scroll down to the news section, see the story about the guy in this bizarre condition. He's fine. It's not painful. It's painful to watch a little bit, but it's not painful to do. And he says he's the only guy in the world that can do this. I would argue he's not the only one going through the world back asswards, but it's different. Also there, if you look at it, there's a cool video. I believe it comes from the Daily Mail about this Garuda herb. It has a snake-like characteristic. The herb, it looks like about a 6 or 8 inch snake. And you put it in a bucket, and if you pour water into the bucket, the herb appears to defy gravity and swims up the stream of water from the bucket. I mean, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it literally like finds the stream and starts to go up it until it climbs itself out of the bucket. The weirdest thing. It's real. You can go see it. And there's yet a lot of strange things going on in the water, some of which have to do with Hawaii. Tropical storm Lane is now a big rainmaker for the Hawaiian Islands. Widespread flooding occurring with up to 40 inches of rain possible. That's why the most devastating part of this storm is really just happening now. This is from weather.com, but they say that health officials in Hawaii are also urging residents to avoid floodwaters. Now, right? I mean, that just makes sense. You want to avoid floodwaters because you don't want to get swept away. And some of these have been coming through and just ripping through communities, taking out homes. I haven't heard a lot about a high death count yet, praying that that doesn't happen. But when you see some of the devastation of these raging floods that look like the washes I mentioned in Arizona, you would think, how's everybody gotten by so far? But that's not actually what they're worried about. It's not actually the floodwaters so much as it's the years of chemicals, bacteria, and other toxic substances in the water that's causing the greatest fear. There's a lot of agricultural land there, and so there's a lot of runoff that they're fearing is coming out all at once, coming right into the water. Entering floodwaters with cuts and other open wounds increases your chance for infection, not to mention that creepy Garuda herb might be crawling up your leg too. But that's not, did you see the story earlier in this week of the guy who gotten bit by a shark? The shark was like eating him alive or trying to, but that wasn't the hard part. The hard part is when the guy was rescued, the flesh eating bacteria that was in the water had gotten in the wound and that started eating him alive. So I think they were able to successfully stop the flesh-eating bacteria from doing any further damage to his leg. But here he was. They had sewn up all the cuts from the shark bites, and now they were sort of made doubly painful with the flesh-eating bacteria. And meanwhile, from England, the first time that's ever happened in England, there's other parts of the world that has reported this, but it appears to be creeping across the globe. Not a pandemic, but a flesh-eating STD, sexually transmitted disease. So like the thing that you pick up from the water, but you're not big enough for the water. And I mean, it's a terrifying thought of what it starts to eat first. Who needs Catholic guilt? Just, you know, flash those pictures around to the kids. That should end festivities right there. Yikes. Yet that plant that swims upstream like a snake, runaway runoff in paradise, and an STD that is not just the clap, it's like a standing ovation. None of that is compared to the stories of sustained weirdness on coasttocoastam.com that we collect all week long. Tim Banal is the news director of coasttocoastam.com. You may know him as the host and creator of the broadcast of the podcast Banal of America. He also covers the paranormal news beat for us, writing most of the original articles that you see during the week. And every Friday, he's been joining us here at the start of the show with a roundup of some of the most fascinating stories from the last week and helping us put like a little capstone on those stories. Let's bring up Tim. Good evening, Tim.
How you doing, Ian? It's great to be back. Great to be talking to you again tonight. Hope you had a great week.
I had a terrific week, and I've been reading this book all week, Strange Stars, about the way that science fiction mainstreamed and pop music had decided to deviate from the mainstream and become more like science fiction. It's a really cool book, and we'll be talking about some of the most famous examples of that and how they were directly impacted by science fiction in a minute. But do you like that period of the sort of the late 60s, 70s period of music?
Yeah, I'm a big classic rock fan for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So if you had to name a song which you thought was based on a science fiction story, one which was maybe even in and of itself a science fiction song, a song completely like a self-contained little science fiction narrative in a song, can you think of one?
Yeah, there's one that I really love. I hope it kind of fits the bill. Creedence Clearwater Revival. It came out of the sky. It's about a UFO crash.
Yeah. See, now that's interesting. So this is, I'll ask Jason about that because I'm not sure. I heard him mention that, but I do like that story. And so that'll be one we'll get to. But I mean, some of the things that we'll be talking about coming up are songs which I have known always and did not realize in a way. I didn't connect the dots like he does in how the artists were reading a science fiction novel and then decided to put that into a song. And then on the other side of that, too, I believe so much of that influenced actual science. And we'll get back to that coming up in just a second. But let's find out what were the big stories this week at coasttocoastam.com, Tim, that some people may have missed and they need to take a look at when they go to coasttocoastam.com tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess you could call these Banal's best bits. These are the.
Yeah, I love that. That sounds great. Okay.
So these are sort of like my three favorite. And we set it up on the Coast to Coast AM website where you can go and find these. I'll sort of guide people as we go along. So at the number three spot in the carousel is a really amusing story I found. I kind of picked this one out in the sense that I thought you'd get a chuckle out of it. A man in England, he's in trouble with the law. He broke up with his fiance. Marriage fell apart. And well, the planned marriage, of course. And he's been trying to get back together with her, and she's had enough. And he's in trouble for harassing her. And the long story short, in a sense, is that he sent her a number of anonymous letters. He's accused of all this, of course. So he's going to have his day in court. But she received a number of anonymous letters. And the one that made headlines was one that looked like it came from a nearby tarot shop. And it got across the message that it was a message, quote-unquote, from his ex-fiancée's late mother, who was imploring her to get back together with him. And the message was a lot like what you would expect someone faking a message from the other side would be like. So it's, you know, the man who sacrificed everything for you, the man who loves you, the man who wanted you to be his wife, and urged her, telling her to call her. All you have to do is call him, it said in the letter. So, and his defense for all this is, I don't know anything about it. I don't. Yeah. Must have been a friend of ours who's trying to get us back together, which to me is like, who needs friends like that? What, what kind of friend like that is? You're on trial, man.
But I will tell you, I know somebody that this happened to, for reals.
Really?
And I just talked to her 3 weeks ago. She had never been married. Her mother was in later stages of life, and she was lamenting to her daughter, you know, one of the things I always fear most about passing on is that you're going to be alone. And she kept bringing up a kid, which my friend had known like in third grade or fourth grade. I mean, they knew each other, but they never really dated. And she kept bringing him up going, I kept thinking you'd end up with him. And she was like, yeah, Mom, I mean, yeah, nice. He was a nice kid, but, you know, that was about it. When her mother died, that guy reached out to her on Facebook. And then what was even weirder, this was really weird, she said when they went, they were putting away some of her things after her mother died, and she found a photo that her mother had found of this woman friend of mine and her fiancé, they've since married, when they were like in third and fourth grade, a picture that she had put in her scrapbook prominently at the end of her life.
Wow.
Now that's just like, that gave her chill. It gave, the way she told it, much better than that, but it was still cool. All right. So that's speaking of schoolgirls, there's this cool photo. I just saw the headline about this girl that took the photo of Nessie. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. A young girl, about 12 years old, she was visiting Loch Ness with her family on vacation and snapped a pretty good picture. It's up in the number two spot on the coasttocoastam.com website. It's a pretty good picture, and one of the researchers there in Scotland said it's one of the best he's seen in years. And what stood out to me, I thought was interesting, when you're sort of surfing the paranormal news wave like I do, what I thought was fascinating was, you know, we cover all these Nessie sightings throughout the year. And since May, this is the third schoolgirl to have a Nessie sighting this summer. It's really weird. And it got me thinking. I was wondering what that was all about.
Maybe reaching out to the unjaded, reaching out to kids who have an open mind.
That's exactly it. Yeah, that's what I think it is. And who else? Adults don't look.
Right, you know? Right. And the kids are looking, and not to mention the kid has like a camera in her hand like 24/7 anyway. So she's probably taking 8,000 photos. You know, it's interesting. But all right, so then the Scottish hills of heather then bring us into this third story about this heather experience. I did not look at this story. It's at coasttocoastam.com. I saw it in the carousel at the top of the page. But all right, so go ahead and tell me about this.
Okay, now this is my favorite story of the week. This is absolutely mind-bending. An author on Twitter, her name is Summer Heacock. So she told this story. She says, since she was a child, people have continually mistakenly called her Heather, not Summer. And Heacock is her married name, and it has nothing to do with that, right? Because this has been going on since she was like 3 years old.
Right.
So, and it happens so often that she said it happens maybe once a week at least, that people call her Heather. And it's always Heather. It's not some other name. So it became sort of a joke to her, and even not just strangers. Her doctor slips up sometimes and calls her Heather. Her husband sometimes slips up and calls her Heather. So she always just kind of thought it was just a weird thing that happened, you know. Turns out she had been adopted. And shortly before she, her new parents, you know, took her in, she stayed for about 6 weeks at a facility where they take care of kids before they're adopted. And during that period, she didn't have a name, so they just gave her a random name. She never found out what it was. A couple of weeks ago, she gets a message on social media. Her biological family has found her. And they all get together for a joyous reunion. And while they're all hanging around, she asks, hey, did you ever know what my name was during those 6 weeks that I was in that facility before my parents adopted me? You may have guessed by now what they said.
Yeah. Heather. How spooky.
And amazingly, how they found her was they found her birth certificate, the original birth certificate, name on the thing, Heather.
So creepy, it'll make you weepy, man. I like that. Yeah. That's a great story. And you've got the documentation to prove it, which makes it even better.
Absolutely.
All right, very good. Is that everything then?
That's it, Ian. I'll be back next week with another dispatch from the world of the weird.
I love that. We'll look for you, too, at coasttocoastam.com. Hey, Tim, real quickly, do you like Pink Floyd?
Absolutely.
All right. So coming up when we talk with Jason here about Strange Stars, we're going to play a cut I don't think many people even knew existed of the night that the BBC was covering the U.S. moon landing, the very first one, right? And what did they do? But they brought in Pink Floyd in 1969 to ad-lib space music to the actual landing itself and the moonwalk. And we'll play that. It's amazing that it survived all this time, and we'll get to that coming up. You don't want to miss it, along with some other incredible stories of how science fiction influenced popular music and how, in fact, it all ties back to what we live with every day. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Could pretty much play that whole song. It's a classic. It's central to part of what Jason Heller talks about in the book Strange Stars. We'll get to that in just a minute. But remember everything you've heard, because we'll get back to it coming up in just a second. And we'll play you that little piece before the top of the hour of Pink Floyd performing live on the BBC on the night of the moonwalk. By the way, for all I know, that will be a song that George Norrie will perform coming up tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, the big night. The return to Asheville show starts at 5 o'clock, the Diane Wortham Theater. There is still time to get to that show. Buy your tickets by going online at coasttocoastam.com and then shoot over to Orbitz or whatever your website is of choice. See if you can't get some cheap flight to get there before you miss it. If you do, by the way, too, George is going to be coming up a little closer to me. He'll be in Scottsdale, Arizona, for the Afterlife Symposium. That's later in September. You can find out more about that, too, online at coasttocoastam.com. Can't wait to get this conversation started. You're going to love it. Whether you're a sci-fi fan of the literature, whether you're a fan of that musical period or not, you're going to find this part all fascinating, how these two intersect. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. Strange Stars is the book I've been talking about for a couple of weeks. David Bowie, pop music, and the decade that sci-fi exploded. But it's not all about Bowie by any means. But he is pretty emblematic of that period. Jason Heller is a Hugo Award-winning writer in his own right, who also writes about other people who win Hugo Awards, such as he does here in Strange Stars. He lives in Denver. All right, Jason, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Ian. How are you?
Good. Looking up at the stars where I am, all I see are clouds tonight. But I've been reading the book over the last couple of weeks, and I've been going back and picking up some of the songs which you talk about, which some of which I don't know that I really knew. I mean, some of them are kind of idiosyncratic to British radio. They didn't quite make it over here, so that's been kind of fun. But let's start where you live with this. So you love science fiction writing, and you're not alone, but there was a time when science fiction was kind of on the fringes. It was the kind of thing that a kid might have a, you know, a cheap paperback for in his back pocket, but it wasn't really mainstream. When did that change?
Yeah, that's funny. I was that kid. That was me, for sure. The change has been gradual, and it's kind of been two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. I think that really it's been in about the last decade and a half, where science fiction has really just completely become the completely mainstream movement that's pretty much infiltrated and energized an entire subculture of people that have,
right,
you know, become the culture itself. You know, Marvel movies are obviously a huge, you know, part of why science fiction has gotten so big in these last few years as well.
Well, and so let me play it with a definition on that for a second, because in my life experience, being considerably older than you, young man, I think as I experienced it, it was really the Outer Limits on television in the 60s. It was shows like, lesser shows like One Step Beyond, a little bit of Twilight Zone, which dealt obviously with occasionally science fiction themes, but not always, and Star Trek. That's kind of like when the idea of a science, of a story that was a fictional story that was based on some scientific formula or some scientific phenomenon or scientific speculation that was still in some way rooted in what we would call science fiction as opposed to science fantasy or space fantasy. To me, that's when the corner kind of turned in the 60s originally. And that I think that accounts for some of the biggest names in science fiction winning all those big Hugo Awards, like one year after another. Some of the most famous books in science fiction all came during the 60s, right?
Yeah, 50s and 60s, yeah. That was the golden age of science fiction, as it is officially called in retrospect by science fiction historians. So absolutely, but at the same time, there would be gains made, you know, when there were shows like you mentioned, Twilight Zone, Star Trek in the 60s, that definitely tried to develop and progress and tackle some pretty serious ideas with science fiction. But at the same time, you know, look at the fate of the original Star Trek, right? It did get canceled after three seasons, and it was ahead of its time in that regard. It wasn't a smashing success when it was actually on the air. One of the first big things that really pushed science fiction into the mainstream consciousness as something that can be done seriously and not something that's, you know, maybe as campy or pulpy was 2001 A Space Odyssey in 1968, which, by the way, was, of course, a huge influence on David Bowie when he went to write Space Oddity a year later.
Right. By the way, this came up when I was researching something else, that, you know, we talk about Star Trek, and you're right. I mean, it's certainly the reputation was as a show that it was not a ratings winner over the life of the show. But what's really funny is you look at it in hindsight, because there was only three networks, on the night that Star Trek debuted, it got like a 40 share, which today we look at as Super Bowl numbers. And we go, wow, Super Bowl's getting a 40 share. That was Star Trek's debut night. It went down from there, but it was really, I mean, like any network would kill to have the 1960s numbers that Star Trek was getting and have them today, because, you know, everybody's in these decimal points with all of the, you know, the proliferation of all these channels. So let's talk about, how do you differentiate between science fiction then and like space fantasy, like Star Wars?
That's a great question. Well, Star Wars definitely is science fiction, but, you know, it's science fantasy in the sense that a lot of the tropes and the themes and the archetypes that George Lucas used in Star Wars are just as much drawn from fantasy as anything else, to the point where the Force, it could just as easily be a form of magic, really, when you look at how it operates in those films. As much as something that can be scientifically explained. Of course, Lucas waited until the prequels to try to scientifically explain what the Force was and got some backlash for that. But science fantasy is kind of a smaller subgenre of science fiction. And it was a particularly big and popular one in the 70s. There's not as much science fantasy being made these days, but there were a lot of authors doing it, particularly in the 70s. And I think that was another thing that really aligned itself with a lot of the music that was coming out at the time. Really, to me, the biggest artist of the 70s that was firmly in the science fantasy camp was T-Rex and Mark Bolan. Their music was absolutely this perfect combination between the science fiction ideas of outer space and space travel and going to other planets, and then also at the same time having dragons and mythical creatures,
right?
All of it kind of combined.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I believe me, I'm with you. But like I my friends are like science fiction purists, and they if I ever said the words Star Wars or science fiction, they'd push me out of my chair. So here's let me go back to what you said about David Bowie, because this is key. Up until Bowie, there had been the occasional science-based song, like a science fiction-y kind of song, like, you know, Telstar, technically, I guess, right? By the Tornadoes, that British group that did that instrumental. That was kind of, but there were no lyrics to it, but I mean, it was sort of in that realm. And then there's like a little, like even you could say like One-Eyed Flying Purple People Eater or whatever, you know, maybe that was a little bit on that. But it really wasn't until Bowie's Space Oddity if I get your point on that, that really is where the two things started to really rub up against each other, because he had been reading a lot of science fiction novels, and then he was reinterpreting them into science fiction songs.
Right, yeah. So, you know, leading right up to Space Oddity in 1969 is when rock musicians started to express science fiction a little more seriously in music. You had people like The Byrds and Jimi Hendrix and Pink Floyd, with Syd Barrett still in the band, were starting to do some of that. But it wasn't really something that was very accentuated, and it wasn't helped by the fact that these bands already, or these artists already, had kind of identities already formed. David Bowie was pretty much an unknown when Space Oddity came out in 1969, so he kind of benefited from having this blank slate identity-wise, and that was kind of what he got pegged as. And what made that song so remarkable, as you mentioned, was the fact that here was someone who was not using science fiction as a novelty element. You know, David Bowie was actually using his lifelong love of science fiction and his infatuation with Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey to really kind of channel what was really kind of the darker side of the space craze that was going on with the race to the moon at the time between the U.S. and Russia, which, of course, America won. And that was that while there's all this heroic, triumphant, patriotic, jingoistic, we're going to the moon attitude, there's also the ideas that are expressed in Space Oddity by David Bowie, that what if we go into outer space and things go wrong? What if we look back at Earth and it kind of drives us a little bit crazy to be floating in outer space and looking back at our home planet? So Bowie really kind of captured the flip side of what was going on in popular culture. And the fact that Space Oddity came out right when the Apollo 11 moon landing happened, it just was the right song at the right time, and it sparked, as I write about in Strange Stars, an entire decade of this very fertile period of space exploration and science fiction and technological development, all really seeping into the groundwater of popular music.
Yeah, we're talking with Jason Heller, author of Strange Stars. So, as you say, Bowie's song, Space Oddity, came out right about the time of the U.S. moon landing. But it was a song about failure. It was a song about catastrophic mission failure. But because there were no other songs really for TV or radio to pull from, while suddenly everybody's talking about going to the moon and we're going into space, they were kind of left playing this really, or left with it, or they didn't bother to actually listen to the lyrics to this really dark song about what happens if everything breaks down. And so you got that juxtaposition of, hey, we made it, USA, USA. And we're playing a song from a British guy who was talking about, you know, somebody drifting off into space who's never going to talk to his lovely wife again.
Yeah, well, I relate an anecdote that illustrates exactly that in the book. If you'll remember, there's a BBC producer whose name has been lost to history, who during the days of the moon mission, the Apollo 11 mission, was looking for a song, some music to play over the top of some of the footage that was being broadcast from the moon of Neil Armstrong and company. And this producer at the BBC thought, realized there was this song. Oh, he had heard this song by this guy, David Bowie, and it's about astronauts or something. Put that on over the top of the footage of Neil Armstrong. So there was actually a whole audience, a British audience, who were watching this footage in 1969 of Neil Armstrong on the moon and hearing David Bowie's Space Oddity over it, which is quite that's really some cognitive dissonance going on
yeah.
there.
It's like the Emerson, Lake and Palmer tune "I Believe in Father Christmas," which is really dark and depressing. And
right.
I like they're playing it at the malls, and it's like, people, don't you understand? That's not a pro Christmas tune, really.
Right. Or Father Christmas by the Kinks, another great example. Right.
Exactly. So. All right, but then let's talk about Pink Floyd, because this is another early group, which many of us know later on, obviously, from Dark Side of the Moon, which was not technically really a sci-fi album. It was just part of their thematic exploration and stuff. I love this story, and I went looking for it, and I think I found it. So I'm afraid I haven't found it, because I don't know against what to measure this, because it is so weird, but... So the in England for the night of the famous walk on the moon with Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, the BBC brought in Pink Floyd to perform live while people are talking and commenting on what we're seeing via the satellite. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, they brought them in and had them improvise. Pink Floyd was already known at that time, even though they, just been around for a couple years, were really known at the time already for having a lot of outer space lyrics and ideas and particularly sounds in their music. And so they brought in Pink Floyd and asked them to improvise live, just basically jam during some of this footage and commentary as this live broadcast was happening. And the composition was titled Moonhead, and it was never recorded or broadcast in any other way after that. It was just this one perfect piece of improvised music made specifically for that reason at that exact moment in history. And it's such a huge part of the way science fiction and science fact and popular music and history all kind of dovetailed at this moment.
Oh, yeah.
And we all know we think we know everything about Pink Floyd. They're one of the most overexposed bands in the world, right? And yet here's this little nugget that has kind of just been lost. And that was one of the things I was trying to get to with writing Strange Stars, was when it comes to the science fictional side of popular music, there's this whole secret history that just has kind of been forgotten or ignored.
Yeah. But can you imagine how weird that would have been if Walter Cronkite, because I stayed up that night, I was nine, I stayed up and or was woken up and plunked in front of the television, and I watched it live. But can you imagine if it was Walter Cronkite who suddenly said, "Now let's play the music of King Crimson while we're watching the moon land"? I mean, it's such a strange thing.
British culture way different than American culture,
right?
For sure.
So here's Moonhead. I'm just going to roll it in the background as we go up to the top of the hour, and we'll get more with Jason Heller coming up. But so here's Pink Floyd playing on the BBC while they're showing images from the moon landing. We'll even hear some people talk here, right? There's a couple of like people that suddenly pipe up. Who was talking?
Yeah, it was just the commentators on the BBC there in the studio. You had Pink Floyd in one room, and then people weighing in with their opinions and commentary about the significance of the moon landing simultaneously.
Yeah, okay. So Moonhead, anybody can find this. Again, I'm glad this is it, because it looked like it was, but you can't always trust YouTube, because people, yeah, here we go, turn that up. It's like the commentators were on LSD along with the band.
Well, anyone can talk over Pink Floyd playing, and it's going to sound like they're on LSD. So.
I guess. So there we go. So you'll find it on YouTube, but we've got more for you from the book Strange Stars coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.